I'm here with David Commission, who is the ambassador to the Caribbean community, CARICOM. Mm. Thank you for agreeing to this interview today.
Yes. I was saying that we should start at the beginning to look at Barbados's connection with the UK. As we all know, Barbados was Britain's mother colony in the Caribbean. One of the Britain's earliest colonial acquisitions in the Caribbean, going back to 1625. But it became the mother colony after Barbados pioneered, or the British settlers in Barbados pioneered the sugar revolution, installing sugar plantation culture in Barbados, one of the world's earliest capitalist enterprises, based on the super exploitation of African labor to generate super abundant profits. It produced virtually the first billionaire class, and Barbados generated enormous wealth for Britain. So that is the history of Barbados. Barbados has a colonial history that is singularly British, unlike most other Caribbean territories that changed hands, went through various European colonialisms, French and Spanish. Barbados was a British colonial possession from 1625 to its independence in 1966. So Barbados helped to fuel much of Britain's development in that 300-year span. The black Barbadian population, several generations of the black Barbadian population lived out their lives as slaves on British plantations here. All of the fruits of their labor was siphoned off to British families, British companies, the British royal family, ultimately to the British government and to Britain itself. So the black people of Barbados played a very important role in developing that wonderfully wealthy modern industrial society that constitutes current day UK. Also of significance is that when Britain entered the Second World War, many Barbadians made their way to the UK, either to fight for Britain in the war, to serve as Air Force men, soldiers, most famous of all, our first Prime Minister, Errol Walton Barrow, who served in the British Air Force, fought something like 40-something, flew 40-something missions over Europe as a navigator during the Second World War. But as you know, during the Second World War and thereafter, there was a great demand in Britain for labor. First of all, labor to help with the wartime industries. But after the war, labor to help rebuild Britain. And Barbados being the most densely populated British colony of the Caribbean, and not just one of the most densely populated, but one of the most oppressive. Barbados was the center of white power, very oppressive plantation society. And so the black masses of Barbados were always seeking some place to run to, greener pastures where they could live less restrictive lives. And so Barbados probably vies with Ireland as the country that on a per capita basis has provided the most migrants. So Barbados has a tremendous record of outward migration, and many Barbadians went to Britain in the post-World War II period in search of greener pastures, but also to, answering Britain's call for labor to help rebuild the society. And it's important to understand that the Britain that these Barbadian migrants were going to was a Britain that their ancestors' labor had helped to construct. So they were simply following the resources of their ancestors. Yes, so 1966 we become independent. We are now juridically equal to the UK, the independent government of Barbados from 1966 sees its UK counterpart as its equal, and the Barbados soon after achieving independence in 1966, Barbados becomes part of a Caribbean integration organism known as CARIFTA in the first instance, the Caribbean Free Trade Association, established in 1968. And by 1973, CARIFTA has evolved into the Caribbean Community, CARICOM. Mm-hmm. So from 1973, Barbados is negotiating its relationship with Britain, mm-hmm. both bilaterally in terms of Barbados-UK relations, but also multilaterally as part of the Caribbean community. So that is a bit of the background that takes us to that lays, you know, the framework for considering the Windrush scandal, the Windrush incident.
So I'd also like to learn a little bit about yourself as well, mm-hmm. because you're a very well-known Pan-Africanist. Mm-hmm. I just wondered how much of your of that has mm-hmm. Entered into kind of your activities, basically, and your work. And mm-hmm. because that, like, as I understand it, that's absolutely central to mm-hmm. to your own career.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
how that's been shaped.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I got involved in political life in Barbados at a very young age, in 1985. Mm. 1986, I was appointed to the Senate of Barbados. At that time, I was the youngest senator in the history of Barbados.
And you're also from St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
Well, I'm the son of a Methodist minister of religion. Mm. And if you know anything about the Methodists, they move around. So my father served in 8 different Caribbean territories. So I happened to be born when he was serving in St. Vincent. So I was born in St. Vincent. I left St. Vincent at the age of 6. I moved to Trinidad. I did my primary school education in Trinidad. And then I came to Barbados in 1971 and have been here ever since. So I come from a pan-Caribbean family, and I've had a pan-Caribbean experience. But very much a citizen of Barbados and very committed to Barbados. Yeah, so a young politician, but also I guess what distinguished me was that I had an ideological commitment to Pan-Africanism and to democratic socialism. So that marked me from very young in my political career. And then for purposes of this interview, Early around the turn of the 90s, Mr. Bernie Grant, Member of Parliament for Tottenham, one of the first, well, one of the first black British MPs of the modern era, made contact with me and introduced the issue of reparations to me. So I actually have to credit Bernie Grant for introducing me to the issue of reparations.
So why was Bernie Grant talking about reparations? But this was in the '90s, right?
Very early nineties.
Where was this conversation?
Bernie had made a speech in England that had become quite controversial. I think the title of the speech was "Reparations or Bust." Bernie had raised the issue of reparations and repatriation in Britain, and I think he had come under attack at the time, and I think he had launched into a program to defend his views, and I guess as part of that program he reached out to well-known political activists of the Caribbean. So I brought Bernie to Barbados. I arranged for Bernie to give a lecture in Bridgetown, a lecture on reparations. And that became the beginning of the organized reparations movement in Barbados. I subsequently became... So that's the very early 90s. By 1998, I was appointed chairman and director of the Barbados government's Commission for Pan-African Affairs. I was actually, the foremost architect of the Commission for Pan-African Affairs. And this was a groundbreaking institution. It was located within the office of the Prime Minister, but it was the first example of any government that we knew of that established an institution, a governmental institution, that was devoted to Pan-Africanism as an agenda.
Can I ask, did you meet with any British government representatives at the time, or with the High Commissioner, or
as part of the Commission for Pan-African Affairs?
Yes, in a formal capacity. Did you participate in any meetings?
Well, the Commission was established in 1998, and almost immediately after the Commission was established, began the preparatory phase of the United Nations World Conference Against Racism.
Yes.
So I, as head of the commission, became deeply involved in that exercise on behalf of the government of Barbados. So I was involved in all of the preparatory conferences, the Americas region preparatory conference in Chile, all of the preparatory meetings in Geneva, the United Nations in Geneva. And during the course of that process, yes, I came into contact with many British government officials, many European Union government officials, because the Commission for Pan-African Affairs had made the pursuit of reparations one of its agenda items. And so we embraced the United Nations World Conference Against Reparations as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to put the issue of reparations on the international agenda.
Was it taken seriously at that time?
It's taken very seriously. It was taken so seriously that the United States delegation walked out of the UN World Conference in Durban, South Africa, because when we began the process at the Americas region preparatory meeting around maybe 1999 or thereabouts, the U.S. government made it plain that as far as they were concerned, the UN World Conference Against Racism would have nothing to do with declaring slavery and transatlantic slave trade as crimes against humanity,
mm-hmm.
would have nothing to do with the issue of reparations. And that was their position. And from that very first preparatory conference, we, Barbados and the Caribbean, we said to them, we totally disagree.
Was that a united front from across the Caribbean? Or there?
Very much so.
From the Anglophone Caribbean?
Yes, the Anglophone Caribbean. We participated. By the time we got, okay, for most of the preparatory conferences, it was basically only Barbados and Jamaica making the effort to go to Geneva to participate. How a UN conference works. You do a lot of the work beforehand in the preparatory meetings. But by the time we got to Durban, South Africa for the conference,
that was in 2001.
Yes. There was a CARICOM delegation in place. You know, and so we crossed swords with the Americans from very early. We said, no, you cannot have a world conference against racism and not consider the very foundation of modern racism, which is slavery, the transatlantic slave trade, and out of that, the demand of black people for reparations. So we successfully defied the United States. And we were successful in putting onto the agenda of the World Conference resolutions speaking about slavery being a crime against humanity and the fact that reparations are in order. And the U.S. used as their justification for walking out of the conference, they claimed that the conference was introducing items pertaining to Israel and the Palestinian mm-hmm. issue, and that's why they were walking out. But we knew that was just
a smoke screen.
Yes,
it was very much a David and Goliath situation.
Yes. But during those years of preparing for the World Conference and negotiating and all the preparatory meetings, we had we were confronted with the mind boggling spectacle of British and other European Union diplomatic representatives actually getting up in an international forum in the 21st century and saying that they did not owe reparations to black people because slavery was illegal. That, and I mean, the moral blindness and the moral obtuseness of maintaining.
But also complete historical ignorance as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, historical ignorance, but I mean, what makes it so ridiculous is that even within the logic of the British and other European legal systems of the 19th and 18th and 17th century, slavery was deemed to be so-called legal because African human beings were determined not to be human beings, that they were wild beasts, they were animals, they were chattels, they were soulless chattels. I mean, if you go back to the Barbados slavery codes of the 1660s, so in England, slavery had been abolished in England since the 12th century, right? The Westminster Council of Slavery had been abolished, and the criminal law system in England said that if you raped a woman, that was a crime. If you mutilated a person, that's a crime. If you enslaved the person, that was a crime. So the colonial houses of assembly passed legislation which said, because these creatures from Africa are not human beings, they are wild beasts with a different psychology from human beings, the normal legal regimen cannot be applied to them. hence we have devised these slavery regulations. Now, the thing about the Barbados House of Assembly, we had a House of Assembly, a white plantocratic House of Assembly from 1639. They could pass legislation, but that legislation had to be approved by the imperial government in England. So the British government was complicit in a situation where slavery is illegal in England. Lord Mansfield says the air of England is too pure to be breathed by a slave. They permitted the colonial assemblies, and they approved these pieces of legislation that determined that Africans were not human beings. So for a British statesperson in the 21st century to get up in an international forum and say that slavery was legal, and it is because slavery was legal that they don't have to consider the question of reparations, is just really mind-blowing. But that is what we had to contend with at the time of the World Conference against Racism. And the World Conference Against Racism, the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, was a very important step forward in legitimizing the issue of reparations. That was 2001. By 2007, we were commemorating the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade. Mm-hmm. And that brought the issue of reparations to the fore once again. And by 2012, Barbados established a national task force on reparations. Jamaica had preceded Barbados. I think Jamaica had established, the Jamaica government had established their national committee about 2 years before Barbados. Antigua, around the same time as Barbados, they established a committee. And then in 2013, a remarkable thing happened when, at a CARICOM heads of government conference, our heads of government made the momentous decision to establish a CARICOM reparations campaign, to set up a CARICOM reparations commission, and to pursue reparations against the governments of Europe that were implicated in enslavement and the slave trade. And by 2016, CARICOM wrote the Prime Minister who was head of the CARICOM Prime Ministerial Subcommittee on Reparations, which happened to be the Prime Minister of Barbados. Barbados has lead responsibility for reparations within the CARICOM system. So Prime Minister Stewart, on behalf of CARICOM, wrote to six heads of government of Europe, heads of government of the UK, France, Netherlands, Denmark, Spain, and Portugal, informing them that CARICOM was formally making a reparations claim against them, informing them about the CARICOM 10-point reparatory justice plan, and requesting that they meet with CARICOM to discuss this issue and to negotiate a reparations package. All six of those heads of government responded in very, very non-committal ways, basically regretting this negative episode in the history, but that is in the past, and we must go on to, you know.
I can't remember when it was at Sarkozy as well. I remember went to Haiti, and I can't remember what year that was in, but it was also received.
Well, David Cameron came to the Caribbean and told the Caribbean people to forget about it.
That was about the Jamaican prisons as well. He said that you would give Jamaica prison.
Yeah, he said, yes, to house deportees from Jamaicans deported from Britain. When we were trying to raise with him the issue of reparations, So he said we should just forget about it, and he went on to make this offer of money to build a prison, you know, very disrespectful.
I was in Jamaica recently as part of this project, and also what I found fascinating was looking at how UK development funding is being spent as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a centre that basically houses returnees.
Mm-hmm.
So people who've been deported from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was fascinating that this... I find it fascinating that we've built... That we've, through the guise of the same old tricks, right? The guise of development and progress, is building an infrastructure that is essentially forcibly removing people from the UK. And, you know, the discourse around this is... that this is a kind way of treating people. So I think my point there being the infrastructure that the UK has built historically is something that is continuing.
Mm-hmm.
And very much, I think, linked also to questions of repair and acknowledging harm done.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, it's tragic, really, how... Black people of the Caribbean who migrated to the UK have been treated. The original migrants, but also their children and grandchildren. And as we know, I'd made the point that many of our people migrated in the late 40s and 50s. And we all know the story, the hostile response that they faced, the racist abuse, ultimately leading to the Nottingham riots in, I think, 1958.
I also find it fascinating speaking to a gentleman yesterday about the recruitment drives as well, and how Barbados was very much a place to recruit nurses for the NHS, to recruit conductors.
You know, Barbados was known as Little England.
Mm-hmm. Well, still referred to in fact.
Little England, yes. Yes, yeah. No, Barbados was always... Barbados was always providing outward migrants, and although the history of colonialism in developing education and so forth was really abysmal, yet Barbados was slightly ahead of the other territories in terms of the access to education and the educational standards of the Barbadian people. So of all the British colonies in the Caribbean, the Barbadian people would have had a little edge over the others in terms of formal training and education, therefore being able to provide people who could be nurses and police. Well, not police in the case of Jamaica, of Britain, but Barbados also provided migrants across the Caribbean as well.
Teachers
and... Panama, yes. So I think about 60,000 Barbadians went to help build the Panama Canal. But that is testimony to how difficult life was in Barbados. You know, there's so many wanted to leave.
So I am interested in this question of, as you know, we're working on the Windrush scandal, and the correlation then between the Windrush scandal and the question of reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a question that I wanted to
put to you. When we became aware of Windrush in 2018, at that time I was not a Barbados diplomat.
Were you not present at the CHOGM meeting of
2018? No. In 2018, when I became aware, I was in private practice as an attorney at law here in Barbados, and I was the president of a community-based organization known as the Clement Payne Movement, and The document I have holding in my hand is a letter that I sent. It's a letter dated the 23rd of April, 2018. And it's a letter that I sent to the then Secretary General of CARICOM, Ambassador Irving LaRocque. And I signed the letter on behalf of the Clement Payne Movement, the Pan-African Coalition of Organizations, and the Caribbean chapter of the International Network in Defense of Humanity. And basically, the letter is informing CARICOM that on the 21st of April 2018, our organizations held a community grounding in Bridgetown, Barbados, on the Windrush scandal,
which had just kind of hit the front pages at that time.
Yes. And as I said in the letter, the said community grounding benefited from the personal testimonies of a number of Barbadian and other Caribbean nationals who had resided and worked for extensive periods of time in the UK, and who were therefore extremely knowledgeable about the plight of our predominantly black brothers and sisters of Caribbean origin resident in the UK. And we went on to inform CARICOM that after a comprehensive discussion of the matter, that our organizations were mandated by the attendees at the meeting to inform CARICOM of the following. And I'll just go through them quickly. The first point we made was that all persons of Caribbean origin in the UK, whether or not they be British nationals or be entitled to British nationality, remain part and parcel of our pan-Caribbean family and are entitled to the interests, concern, solidarity, and support of the Caribbean people and governments. Secondly, we reminded CARICOM that one of the core functions of CARICOM is to develop for the 15 member states a collective foreign policy and a collective platform for dealing with the outside world and with powerful foreign governments such as the government of the United Kingdom. Thirdly, in light of the foregoing, CARICOM is obligated to take a collective position in relation to the plight of the members of the so-called Windrush generation who have been subjected in the UK to a systematic state-orchestrated racist campaign of unlawful deportations, detentions in custody, denial of medical and other social services, and denial of the right to gainful employment. And it must be noted that there are several cases of the mental and physical stress generated by this racist campaign, resulting not only in physical and mental illness, but also in actual cases of death. And then we went on to make our main recommendation, and I quote, "The affected members of the Windrush generation have suffered the type of racist group injury that requires the application to it of the concept and principles of reparations. That is, the British government must be called upon to fully and unreservedly acknowledge the wrong that has been committed, to genuinely apologize to the victims, to immediately bring a halt to the injurious racist policies and practices, to put in place alternative and remedial policies and practices that are designed to genuinely assist the affected group with confirmation and certification of their legal status within the UK, to immediately extend to deportees the right of return to the UK at the expense of the British government, and to financially compensate all victims for the injuries and damage suffered. CARICOM is under a duty to seek justice for our UK-based brothers and sisters, and to do so by speaking forthrightly to and engaging with the government of the UK in the terms outlined above. So that was, we were saying to CARICOM, yes, the reparation logic and principles need to be applied to the situation of the victims of the Windrush scandal. And we also made the point that while we appreciate that there were grassroots organizations in the UK fighting for justice for the Windrush victims, that they were up against a very powerful adversary in the form of the British government, and that they would need the active solidarity and support of CARICOM and of the governments of the member states of CARICOM.
Did you yourself have direct engagement with the UK government specifically about the Windrush scandal?
Not with the government itself, but I happened to be in the UK when they started holding community meetings pertaining to the proposed compensation program. Mm-hmm. I actually attended one of those meetings in London. I met Mr. Martin Ford, QC, the lawyer who had been, I think, contracted to help design a compensation program. And I did keep in contact with him. I remember he asked me to investigate the case of a famous Barbadian and West Indian cricketer, Collis King, who was one of the victims, had not been allowed to return to the UK, and to his job as a cricket coach in the UK, and was really languishing and suffering in Barbados. So he was just one example of the victims. I also kept in contact with the Black British community organizers who had in fact organized that meeting at which Mr. Martin Ford spoke. The names just momentarily slip me now. Mm. So this letter is April 2018. By August 2018, I am Barbados's, by July 2018, I should say, I am Barbados's ambassador to CARICOM. Having become ambassador, I had to give up much of the community activism that I had been engaged in.
But this letter, you responded incredibly quickly after the scandal kind of erupted. Mm-hmm. Did you see any of the recommendations that you made in this letter? Do you think any of them actually followed through?
Needless to say, we got a response from the Secretary General of CARICOM, mm-hmm. Telling us that thanking us for the input and assuring us that the CARICOM and the High Commissioners in the UK would be not necessarily saying that they accepted the reparations logic that we were proposing, but assuring us that they would continue to follow up on the issue. I don't know. You might be in a better position to tell me to what extent they did follow up seriously, to what extent they have the High Commissioners in the UK have really been of assistance to the Windrush victims.
Did you ever meet with the British High Commissioner here in Barbados? Have you had any discussion with?
Not specifically on this issue. As I said, once I became CARICOM ambassador, then my mandate became
a different
mandate. This was when I was wearing my political and community active and Pan-Africanist hat, you know. So I'm not as familiar with what the current developments are.
So the Windrush compensation scheme has been established, and Wendy Williams was commissioned to write a report with key recommendations for the UK government. And there have been a number of problems with the compensation scheme. It has been widely discredited and criticised for its slow response, also for re-traumatising many people affected by the scandal by making a complex process even more burdensome, as well as the compensation being either inadequate or non-existent. So it's an ongoing issue. It's something that Suella Braverman, for example, recently announced that she was two of the key recommendations from the Wendy Williams report were going to be dropped. The government was not going to follow through on them. So that's where we are at the moment.
Well, you know, it kind of, the Windrush scandal and the way it's being handled, it really compounds the historical injury. And it thumbs its nose really at the claim for reparations, and I think this is something that the British government is really going to have to think very seriously about, because the claim for reparations is not going to fade away. In a sense, the genie is out of the bottle.
And I really wanted to ask you about that, because I was particularly interested that you said that this was about the interest around reparations in the 90s. But would you argue that attitudes have changed, that this is becoming being taken more seriously? And I certainly get... From this project and from the interviews that I've carried out, that I think that particularly British, particularly the diplomatic community, let's just say, are seeing this from afar and seeing that this is something that is coming, right? And I don't know how much how you see the future really in terms of reparations, and in terms of policy makers and decision makers in government actually taking this as a credible movement and something that will eventually lead to recognition.
Well, I think the European governments have to decide if they, going forward into the future, if they want a constructive and mutually respectful relationship with the black and brown people of the Caribbean and Africa and so forth. Because this is the age of information, and people are aware, people are becoming more and more aware of the history and of the atrocities committed, and of the grave injustice that our people suffered, and about how much was actually taken from them, right? So that information is out there, and is only growing with every passing year. And you know, we see our attitude to we see Britain. Britain is our friend. I mean, most of our tourists come from Britain. Britain is a development partner. So we don't see Britain as an enemy or as an adversary. So it's a friendly country that we have good relations with. So we say to our friend, this is the history. This is what was done. You claim that, you know, you're our friend. You have our best interests at heart. But we are saying to you, you have to you have to account for this history. You have to atone for this history. You have to apologize. You have to make some gesture of atonement, you know. And to the extent that a British prime minister comes to the Caribbean and says, forget about it, just get over it, that's insulting. That's insulting.
I know. I was reading recently that Tony Blair, for example, was thinking back to the 90s, but he was offered a honorary degree by UWE, which he turned down because he said he was too busy.
Wow.
And then when Patterson travelled to the UK, again, Tony Blair didn't meet with him because he said he was too busy. And I think it's fascinating how the strategy basically of the UK government is. Even though Labour, for example, the majority of its votes were from the majority of Caribbean people and Caribbean descended people in the UK would have voted for Labour. In fact, they had very little respect, really, and very little focus on actually fostering those relationships. So I think the historical wounds go in many directions as well. I think it's one of neglect and one of a lack of interest and a lack of engagement as
yes,
well.
Yes. I remember meeting with Jeremy Corbyn in London when he was the leader of the opposition and preparing for the election, and he was very open to the cause of reparations.
And he was also concerned about the stories of people whose documentation wasn't being recognised as well, and he picked up on that issue.
Yes.
So it was being flagged to the UK government, but they weren't taking it seriously.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that it is not going to go away, and our reparations claim is rooted in justice, in righteousness, but also in law. And you know, and in historical fact, and when you have all of that going for you, I think you are bound to win once you pursue your cause, you know, with commitment and determination. And I, as I said, I got involved in the reparations cause way back at the beginning of the 90s, when most people would not have taken us seriously. It would have sounded like a pipe dream back then. Now, when the CARICOM governments launched the reparations campaign in 2013, that gave a tremendous boost to the idea of reparations. That helped to establish its legitimacy.
Can I ask about the role of Vereen Shepherd and Hilary Beckles as well in the movement? Just because they're big figures, but.
Well, so Hillary was asked to chair the CARICOM Reparations Commission. Actually, the CARICOM Reparations Commission was basically an idea of the Barbados National Task Force on Reparations. We had this idea of bringing the governments together in a conference and establishing a regional reparations commission. And we shared that idea, but we were very pleased when Prime Minister Gonzales of St. Vincent ran with the idea, and he and Sir Hillary, with the assistance of Sir Hillary, were able to get the other heads of government to accept it. So they were critical in making that breakthrough, in getting the heads of government to make the decision. In July of 2013, to set up the to launch the reparations claim. So Sir Hillary has played a very important role, first of all as chair of the CARICOM Reparations Commission, but also as an historian. And his book Britain's Black Debt, you know, has really outlined
the
case.
It was inspired by the Rodney book, is that
no
correct?
That's the more recent one. The more recent one is how Britain underdeveloped
the Caribbean.
But the real case for reparations, that one is more looking at the 20th century relationship But the Britain's Black Debt, the first major work that he did on this issue, goes deeply into the history of enslavement and the case for reparation. So Hillary and I go back a long way. We were partners in struggle from way back in the 1980s. And we were together in Durban, South Africa, at the World Conference Against Racism. He actually led the Barbados delegation, but he left the conference early, and then I took over as leader. So we have fought, you know, many battles together over the years. Yeah, but yeah, he is seen as the major driving force. And he's gotten a lot of help, yes, from Vereen Shepherd. And Vereen went on to replace Rex Nettleford at the UN Commission for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination and so forth, you know.
And another question I have for you is about the role of, well, the interest of the EU specifically, because of, I just wondered what you thought about a Brexit, the fact that Britain's becoming more insular, that it's separating itself from its European partners, and how you see that moving towards the future. What kind of what implication do you think that has for the UK, not only in terms of its diplomatic relations, but also its kind of approach to reparations? Do you think that has any kind of impact?
There is. There is an effort that is being made to approach the EU with the CARICOM reparations claim. And I know that I've heard from diplomats within the EU saying that they will not support that approach because the EU is not only made up of countries that were involved in slavery and slave trade, but several others that don't have that history, and that they feel that they would be required to undertake burdens that are historically not their responsibility. So I know where CARICOM is concerned. We are targeting all of the European governments and nations that were involved. So far, we have identified 10. We wrote to 6 in 2016, but in the years since then, our research has indicated to us that there are 4 other European countries, Germany, Switzerland, Sweden, and I'm not clear right on the 4th one now, but there are ten that we are targeting. The others haven't been informed yet, but a second round of letters will be going off to the relevant European heads of government, And we are confident. I mean, all of the signs are there. In December last year, Prime Minister Mark Rutte of the Netherlands, who back in 2016, in response to CARICOM's letter, had responded with a very, very non-committal and maybe you could even say dismissive letter, by 2022 was singing a different tune. By 2022, he was coming before the world community to say that yes, his Dutch government had committed crimes against humanity, that those crimes had injured people, and that injury persists up to today, and that they recognize that they have to be involved in a process of healing the injury.
And I think that we are seeing a shift then, aren't we, a global shift? Yes,
there's Netherlands, there's the Anglican Church, the church commissioners who have publicly acknowledged that the church was involved in investments in the slave trade through the South Sea Company, and that benefited financially, and who have apologized, issued a public apology, and have said that they're setting up £100 million investment fund to make investments in communities that would have been negatively impacted. Then there's the recent case of the Trevelyan family. Even before the Trevelyan family, there was another family, Bridget Freeman. Many people seem to be unaware. Bridget Freeman in 2021, a British woman, having learnt that her family had been involved in enslavement in Barbados, she determined that she had to make a reparations gesture, a bequest of the property valued at $500,000 to the University of the West Indies. So you can see a growing momentum. I mean, there's Harvard University making
Glasgow,
you know,
as well, I understand.
University of Glasgow, £20 million to the University of the West Indies, a program valued at £20 million. And there are several British companies that have admitted that they have been they were implicated, they have benefited, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I think we are on our way.
Okay.
And the momentum is building.
I think, though, if we take the Windrush compensation scheme as an example of harm, of repair, of an example of an opportunity for repair,
mm-hmm.
And see and compare that to basically how abysmally, how appallingly the UK government has fared, really,
well,
in compensating the victims. I think it's not a good.
Well, Windrush, Windrush should have been an excellent test case.
Exactly.
Because, as we outlined in the letter, you could easily have taken this and applied all of the reparations principles to it. And my feeling is that from the time CARICOM decided to embrace reparations as part of our official policy, our High Commissioners in Britain need to be aware that this is now part of their mandate, and that they have a responsibility not only to current day Caribbean citizens and nationals, but they have a responsibility to the entire Black British community, you know. And so I think we probably haven't done enough yet to readjust our thinking and our practice to what it means to have reparations as part of your official institutional mandate. So we have some work to do as well. I think we have to be more focused in how we are approaching the reparations campaign. And this, actually, Windrush really presented an excellent opportunity to treat it as a test case and to apply all the reparations principles to it and to win an important victory. So anyhow, I trust that all is not lost and we can still retrieve the situation.
Is there anything else you would like to add before we end the interview today?
No, I think we've basically covered it. I mean, my ultimate point is that this reparations, you can't sweep it under the carpet. You can't try to ignore it and hope that it will go away, which is what I think seems to be the policy of some of these European governments. It is not going away. People are too conscious of the history, and they're only going to become increasingly conscious. And if Europe has to come to terms with the fact that its history is an ugly history. It has been in, it came into this hemisphere. It committed genocide against the indigenous people. It launched that system of enslavement of African people. And when you, anybody who really takes time to investigate the utter brutality of that system, how African humanity was devalued, the horrors of plantation slavery. It's an ugly, ugly history. And you can't sweep it under the carpet. Europe has to acknowledge it, has to come to terms with it, and has to come to terms with the victims of those crimes. And has to show a genuine remorse and a genuine willingness to try to transcend that ugly history. And you cannot transcend it by pretending it never existed. You can only transcend it by taking responsibility for it. And what we are saying, we don't see reparations in terms of individual cash payments. Although, you know, some of us are thinking that you may find a case where there are certain families that have been mired in intergenerational poverty that perhaps targeted cash payments might be appropriate. But for us, our fundamental idea is that Europe's development was purchased at the price of the systematic underdevelopment and the looting and plundering of the resources of our people over hundreds of years. And as a result of that history, we now have a fundamental right to development. And European nations and governments are under a corresponding duty to facilitate that development. So if you look at the CARICOM 10-point reparations plan, it is about developmental. We're calling for a developmental compact with Europe. And, you know, I break it down very simply. A few weeks ago, there was a town hall meeting in Barbados on the disabled community. And there were all of these mothers of disabled children speaking about the fact that they were overwhelmed, speaking about the fact that there's so many needs that their children have, disabled children. But Barbados doesn't have these support mechanisms. Barbados doesn't have these resources. And so many of them were saying, and you know, when you look at Canada and you look at the UK and you look at what they have and facilities for supporting disabled children and for supporting the parents, the families of disabled children, why don't we have those things? And of course, we don't have those things because we don't have the resources. And we don't have the resources because for hundreds of years, our resources went to European families, European companies, and ultimately to the capitals of Europe. So why should a disabled child in Barbados not have access to the same support and resources that a disabled child in the UK or France or, you know, any of these European countries have? So that is what reparations is about. Reparations is about redressing that disparity and that injustice. So you can bring it down to those basic human terms. That's what it's about.
Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.